Welcome to the J3 University Podcast. I'm your host, John Jewett.
And I'm your co-host, Luke Miller.
Our mission is to elevate the physique coaching standard
and deliver the highest level of competitors to the stage.
Let's jump into today's episode. Debunking growth hormone, insulin, and carbohydrates, foods all around that aspect. We see lots of questions, Luke and I, pop up on the J3U forum, but just also through Instagram and DM. And there's lots of confusion around growth hormone and insulin, how they work together, how they work independently. And we wanted to hit today like some of the common questions that we get to debunk this and try to make it clear as possible and demystify these compounds for all of you listeners.
Yeah, I think a lot of this, especially on the insulin side, there's a lot of like preconceived notions from old bodybuilding anecdote that I still see carry over in today. In fact, just on the insulin post I made a couple weeks back, I had like four or five questions that were referring to some of this anecdote of like, I use precarbohydrates and, you know, insulin use and all this stuff. And it's like, how is this still prevalent in the world of a higher level of intellect within coaching? But let's talk about it, because I think like just straight out the gate, like insulin is something that is, with like carbohydrate requirements and everything, just completely misunderstood of like insulin's actual role. What is it actually medically used for? And just kind of where that fits into the bodybuilding process.
Yeah, you know, in J3U, we have the full teaching of how these hormones, growth hormone and insulin, work within the normal physiological process. And it's important to understand that, because if you understand that, of like what's happening in the fasted state when you're not eating, there's a rise in growth hormone because we want to protect tissue. We want to have recovery process happen. Growth hormone liberalizes free fatty acids. Primarily, that's its role, but also inhibits glucose uptake in peripheral tissues, basically trying to provide fuel for the brain as well. Then IGF-1 increases to support all this recovery process. In the fed state, you have glucose and fatty acids you're eating coming in. You have amino acids, so growth hormone levels decline. And then we also would have insulin rising to start to uptake the food that you're eating. Now, I didn't want to go down some big rabbit hole of how all that understanding goes, because this is going to murky us getting to our simple questions around the question. So, but it's hard to give you the short answer and have you understand without having understanding of the background of how we came to that why. So we might touch on it a little bit, but I would definitely encourage you, if you like, you want to go deeper in the understanding of the physiology of these processes and being able to come up with a debunking yourself, then I would highly recommend J3U, because we have full lectures just on insulin, growth hormone, and how they work together. So we can kick this off with our first question, which: does using insulin increase carbohydrate requirements?
Oh man, I love this question, because it's like I've also had some clients that come to me like within the off season, and we're seeing like blood glucose trends roll up, and I'm starting to kind of put out the feelers of their insulin access and where we're at with that. And they're like, well, how much are we going to have to add to cover this? Are we using the 10 gram of carbohydrates per IU, or whatever this 10-to-1 ratio is that gets purveyed? And it's like, we need to understand that from an insulin management standpoint, especially if we're using a basal insulin, we're primarily concerned with, one, giving the beta cells of the pancreas a little bit of a break. When we are peak all season as a bodybuilder, we are pushing food to a place that is going to lower our response to that, especially when we start talking about systemic inflammation, performance that is at its all-time highest, body fat's higher. We're not going to be having a response to carbohydrates that's quite as good. So we're trying to utilize this in a way that's going to take load off the pancreas, but also from a health management standpoint, the actual cardiovascular detriment just from like endothelial cells, when we stay chronically in an elevated blood glucose environment, is another reason we're going to be looking at potential insulin use. So all of that to say, it's not increasing the requirements of carbohydrates that are actually in the plan. They're actually meant to help us manage what's actually already being used to drive the all season progress from a bulking perspective. And so tissue accumulation will occur. We're able to handle this without as much health detriment. And a lot of times it extends all seasons for most athletes.
Yeah. So you just flip that question around, right? So, or the answer is, does using insulin increase carbohydrate requirements? And no, it's increasing carbohydrate intake causes an increase in insulin requirements. Yeah. Now, that's your own insulin production, but like Luke is saying, at some point with a lot of food, you could have a challenge to your own ability to produce that amount of insulin. We can cover some of that need. That gets into like another question that comes up. I don't know if I have it on our list here, is of does taking insulin cause insulin resistance? So should you cycle insulin because of that? And it comes right off that one. And it's a yes and no. Like if you looked at what's happening at the same time, you'd say, well, you're producing more insulin, you're getting more insulin resistant. These things must mean one causes the other, but it's more so you have to think, for one, what's a root drug that we use in diabetes management? It's insulin, right? So we give diabetics insulin to help with management of diabetes. So we're not giving them a drug that causes further insulin resistance. The real issue and the root cause, the background that's probably occurring, and it is multifactorial, but we do look at, in those conditions, there's also a lot of metabolic syndrome that's occurring, but increases in body fat, more so visceral fat stores, cause an increase of inflammation in the body. Let's just leave it at that because it can get more complicated. But all these inflammatory factors that increase can cause an issue in peripheral tissue, organs, that decreases insulin sensitivity. So it's more so the underlying inflammation of an environment that produces that causes insulin resistance to occur. Now, this could be from chronically high elevated blood glucose. Also, those can alter proteins and enzymes that favor glucose metabolism. Elevated free fatty acids can cause issues around it too. So you have just a whole environment that causes it. But basically, getting excessively fat is what could be a problem around insulin resistance. Now, that's not to say that if you gain some body fat, you're going to get more insulin resistant. But in general, that's kind of how that trend goes. So yes and no. Like potentially, if you're seeing higher amounts of food, you're gaining more body fat. In turn, you might be getting more insulin resistant and have at the same time more insulin that is required. But insulin in and of itself is not necessarily causing that insulin resistance. So it's just one way to understand how to think about that. So would you need to cycle off insulin? No, you're just utilizing insulin to your need around blood glucose management. Mm-hmm. Now, the real issue why you need to come back and pull down insulin is at some point, you're going to have to restore greater insulin sensitivity. Now, the way Luke and I program around PEDs, caloric surplus increase, body fat increase, a lot of times we're not having to run into those issues because we're keeping everything at a level that facilitates optimization, quote unquote, right? So we're not having like an excessive calorie surplus, large cheat meals that drive more body fat gain. We're not taking someone to a place that's plus 20% body fat. We're not using drug designs that are 5 grams of steroid per week and 20 IUs of growth hormone. If you do all those things, you're going to quickly run into an area where you get very insulin resistant and have to pull back a lot. We're not taking it to those levels to where that's going to be required, and we can maintain good insulin sensitivity throughout the duration of an off season.
I think potentially this is where people who dabble in it the first time see a lot of issues, is they come in with the expectation that insulin use requires more carbohydrates. More carbohydrates being plugged in pushes that rate of gain really high. That rate of gain takes them to a place that is just going to be chronically inflamed and under responsive. And then they blame the insulin for that place. And it's just this circle that happens. And in reality, they're just managing their plans poorly, but it's not the insulin that's actually driving the issue.
insulin made me.
Yeah, fat. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Exactly.
It's like no, too much food made you fat. Particularly, probably too much carbohydrate. But in turn, yeah, just too much food. And I would say on that note too, like there's certain individuals that aren't going to see the benefit around insulin, or not even the benefit. They just don't have the need for it. And it's probably those that came from a background where you do accumulate body fat easier. Maybe if we went by somatotypes, it's like the endomorph, yeah. Right? You store body fat easy. Those are guys that usually can't go really high food anyway in the off season, or really high carbohydrate for that matter as well. And so they just don't have the insulin need to even be using it. So when you have that person that then brings in insulin and a big calorie surplus, they get even fatter. So it's someone that might not even use it in the off season, regardless of anabolics and growth hormone and all that application, you might not have that person using it. So again, all this stuff comes down to what do you need in your design?
Yeah, for sure. I think a question we have on our list that might pair well with this is the question around growth hormone, right? And do you need to take insulin with growth hormone usage? Because there's always that association that like as soon as growth hormone goes in, it's kind of prevalent that it's talked about together or tangentially. And so I always get the question of like, well, does insulin need to go in off the forefront? And kind of accurately answering that in potentially the transient elevation that you might see, but that the over the time we're not seeing that insulin response be negative. It's more going to be just the progression off season. But kind of walk through the steps of like, you know, if GH goes in, does insulin need to go in immediately? Why or why not? And then potentially start to kind of go down that path.
I would think of these drugs as completely separate items and not having to be paired together, mm-hmm. because the need for them comes from different places. Like we have in the clinical setting, right? People that require growth mm-hmm. hormone. Clinical setting, we have people that require insulin. Mm-hmm. Now, there is crossover when they might both be needed. And what we see is, so let's talk about just insulin sensitivity and resistance just for the second around growth mm-hmm. hormone. There is growth hormone deficient individuals and that are actually insulin resistant. And bringing in growth hormone to those individuals actually improves insulin sensitivity. And there's a lot of things around that component for those individuals. Now we have the opposite side of the spectrum, people that have growth hormone excess, right? Acromegaly, that are very insulin resistant, and bringing them back down to a normal range, they improve insulin sensitivity. So really, like if you're in this normal physiological range, growth hormone facilitates a positive metabolic environment where you have good insulin sensitivity, can metabolize fats, glucose well, but going to these extreme ranges is where it becomes problematic. So what about those that have normal physiology and take growth hormone? Within a certain dose range, you might see an acute rise of blood glucose. However, it seems to normalize after that. And blood glucose, and we'll have to talk about this at some point as well, is only one side of the equation. If you're looking at fasting serum blood glucose, because it's just looking at one time during the day when we see large fluctuations. But what also determines your insulin sensitivity is not just the glucose rise, but what happens with insulin. And that's why I like to use like a HOMA-IR mm-hmm. calculation where you can take your blood glucose, you can take your insulin number on your labs, you can calculate this, and there'll be a different range of values. And going over a one on this scale means you're starting to get in the territory of less insulin, of more insulin resistance. So I try to keep people under one ideally. So just because you have growth hormone in and maybe you see some just transient rise in blood glucose does not mean that you're getting insulin resistance or all day long you're seeing elevations in insulin that would mean you're getting into that state. So really we need to look at both sides of the picture when we're evaluating this. I think sometimes people get overly anal just measuring blood glucose all the time when you start off on growth hormone. But staying within a certain range, completely won't have issues around developing insulin resistance with growth hormone. Now, however, usually we see this in the off-season setting with growth hormone is going in and food is escalating up. Insulin requirements are then increasing because of carbohydrate and calories are rising. And you're also going to get a little bit of less insulin sensitive. So at that turn, you might have someone that absolutely would need some insulin along the way to help with managing that inflammation that's occurring and also their blood glucose. Now, usually that's going to be always in place for someone that's on the higher end of the scale for food and growth hormone. And absolutely, if you go into the higher areas for growth hormone usage, which I would say over 4 IUs, if we had to like put a general number there, is someone that's probably going to benefit from using at least a degree of insulin to help offset some of the amount that you're having to output. But growth hormone of itself, usually we're seeing rises of growth hormone in the fasted state. So when you wake up in the morning, post-training, or those would be it, but post-training. I was about to say before bed, but like during sleep. So usually you see growth hormone rise in a state where you're fasted. Now, if you're taking growth hormone exogenously and you're eating, that's coupled with pretty high glucose rise, and you're a little bit more resistant on the peripheral side of uptake. So over time, just like our patients with acromegaly, will lead to insulin resistance. So it is a point where insulin should go in, but insulin is not the fix either, because you're only going to keep getting more insulin resistant with food increasing over time. So at some point you will have to pull back. But again, just try to manage your body fat gain, and you won't have to take it all the way to that point.
And just to kind of,
did I answer that?
You did. I'm just going to make a, is it the chicken or the egg point here real quick? Is like across a contest prep with exogenous growth hormone in play, you don't see the need for insulin arise across a contest prep when you're in that deficit. So pointing to even further that it's not specifically just the growth hormone that's driving the blood glucose elevation or the insulin serum insulin elevations. And I just want to retweet or emphasize, or however you want to put it, the point of using something like a HOMA IR, because I've had a couple inquiries this year of people coming in with the, what's the blood glucose monitor that goes on the arm?
Continuous.
Yeah, like the continuous monitor that like aren't diabetics and don't need it. And it's like, man, like you were just, yeah, you're just going to a place that's so unneeded in order to kind of manage this well.
Honestly, man, I've kind of gotten away from like, I used to do a weekly, let's check fasting blood glucose. Yeah. I don't do that as much anymore. Just with labs every 10 to 12 weeks and checking a HOMA IR, can see how that just trends, because likely over a 10 to 12 week time, it's not going to need some acute management necessarily. And you can almost do some pre-planned strategies with individuals for having your basal insulin present. Mm-hmm. Just because what I find is people get, it's overly complicated. Mm-hmm. Cause you see like a little bumping blood glucose one morning and they were like, oh man, like what's going on? And it's like, oh yeah, you have like sleep was off. Like I had my meals later. I wasn't hydrated. My glucose test strips were old. Like all these things that can go and make an off reading, a one-off. And then we're having, you know, we could check postprandial in times like that. So it just, if you're keeping someone lean and you have all the subjective measures that are positive, like they have good pumps in the gym, appetite's going well, it's likely something I don't think we need to be measured all the time, like what has been, because some people get a little too focused on the trees and miss sight of the forest in that sense. I don't know if you've seen that within your coaching?
I think I treat it differently now. Like it's not a data point that's overly objective to me. For me, it's more of a subjective metric, in that I'm using it as a red flag for the other subjective metrics coming into play. And it's kind of like large fluctuations are what I pay attention to. So like if we're seeing somebody trend fairly well, and then we see a couple weeks of high, and then you also see appetite tank, and then you also see sleep tank, it's like, okay, there's some aspects of potential deload needing to come in, but I'm not using it strictly as in like insulin deployment, but I will still track it just as I kind of view it more as a subjective metric now rather than this objective data point number, because of all the things that can skew it that you pointed out.
Yeah. Like even with, with like taking growth hormone at nighttime, I'll see elevated fasting blood glucose, but they're fine the rest of the day. And partly that could be like dawn phenomenon. So there's just a, from a lowering of blood glucose tonight, just a more robust response of increasing glucose in the morning, requiring a little bit more higher insulin demand. But again, if you looked at the full picture, mapped it out for the day, it would totally be fine. Yeah. So it's something to still realize is occurring, to measure, but to not get overly focused and look at the big picture for someone. The other point to that question was, you know, do you have to use insulin with growth hormone? But also for insulin, you can use insulin without using growth hormone.
That was...
And it comes back to the exact same point of when do we use insulin? It's like when you have a greater need for insulin secretion, and that's when you might utilize it in that setting. So this is going to be the guy that maybe has a very high food demand and challenging output of your own production of insulin. Then you could use a little bit to extend that off-season phase. So don't think that they have to be run together. They absolutely could be deployed separately, but a lot of times they do happen to be put together because there's crossover with growth hormone could cause a little bit more insulin resistance and in turn demand of insulin because of that.
Yeah. The viewpoint of them being separate entities is how I explain it to most people. Like, I just always circle back to that because it's just the easiest way to differentiate them and show that it's just a needs basis. And I think that kind of does bring us to like, okay, you have growth hormone in play, you have high serum glucose. What do you do? Like what's the answer to that question, right? Like, what are we, cause we've mentioned the Huma IR, but like you're noticing maybe that Huma IR starts to go up. You're seeing that trend go up over time. What are we doing? Like, which type of insulin are we plugging in immediately? What's the next steps with the client to manage this? Are we pulling the plug on phases? A lot of contextual information to lay out, but like when you see that need start to arise, like where are we going next?
Yeah, I find that like if it's reactive or proactive strategies for some of these compounds, that can be fine. After you've worked with someone for, you know, at least gone through a phase, even part of an off season, I think you'll quickly know if this is someone that needs insulin already in place, like right out the gate. So a lot of times when we start our off-season phase, there might be a small basal amount of Lantus going in. This might be 5 to 10 IUs, and then maybe even some Humalog around one of your largest meals. And we just have that in place like right away. That way we're not waiting to the point 12 weeks down the road, we pull labs and we see Homa IR. It's like getting above that one. It's like, oh, damn, we should have already had this in place. Now let's react. So I think you have that situation. Like once you're coaching someone, you can then already know the clients that you need to put those items into place. But if like we are monitoring blood glucose and seeing that starting to trend up over time, we're also seeing some other subjective indicators, like there's a decrease in appetite occurring. That could be indication of like putting in some insulin in that scenario. Mm-hmm. Now, if you still see glucose starting to trend up, and I try not to go above like using, you know, 20 IUs of Lantus, a lower long acting, and also 10 IUs of total Humalog throughout the day, total, not like per meal or anything like that. So that might be 5 IUs, you know, twice a day. If we're still seeing trends up and we already have all the other items that should be taken care of to managing insulin sensitivity. So this is, you know, sleep quality is well, and we've addressed, you know, sleep apnea, anything like that. We're also, again, to a point of don't use a PED design that takes away your ability to sleep or your ability to eat. That would be the first step, because if you kill off that, you're not going to grow. So address those items. Also on that are like they manage well in stress, because stress is going to drive up blood glucose too. So you can have like accumulating factors causing in the off season, right? Poor sleep from just being too big, too heavy, having sleep apnea, a high stressed life. Then on top of it, are they managing their eating throughout the day with, you know, untracked food? Mm-hmm. Are we keeping cardio in? Are they staying, like, doing little walks after each meal? Do we have, like, a diverse diet with fruits and vegetables? And if, you know, if doing all these things that should be checking all the boxes and done right, we're still seeing blood glucose trend up. It's kind of the question of how long do we keep them in that phase and accept that to occur before we need to pull back? Because insulin resistance is only going to get worse. And what I find is usually guys, just their appetite kills off, dies off, and you start having to force feed them. And that's when I just see it worsen really, really fast, where they feel more bloated throughout all day. We're seeing a greater partition towards body fat gain. They also seem more responsive to swings in water retention. And I don't want to say like body inflammation's occurring, but it does seem that there is some type of response there. So at that point, I don't force feed anyone. That's usually a point of like, all right, let's pull back on PEDs. Let's pull back on food. That might start for some people a mini fat loss phase off the tail end of a push, or we just pull it back into like a holding maintenance phase. But you don't want to keep pushing someone beyond, because it really gets like suboptimal for the rate of fat gain that occurs. Muscle gain, you could really argue that one. I think you could probably keep gaining some tissue, but more of the issue is that cost of muscle gain, it costs a lot higher for the amount of fat gain required to make it happen. So that's usually my signs of like, hey, it's time to pull someone back. When we're seeing those items occur.
Yeah, I use all the same signs, but I do love that this question is in the questions for today, because I think, I hate to bring up some somatotypes again, but let's talk about like the ecto, like the guy that's like,
sure,
like takes a ton of food to get through these off-season phases, like these people that these food requirements are like 57, 58, 6,000 in these peak all seasons, you know. This lack of response that we're seeing with all these variables that were just laid out, a lot of times requires a pullback and pulling the plug at that point that's not body fat driven. And so I've actually had to kind of go into like rephrasing like these diet phases or these tidy ups in all seasons, because, you know, they think like, well, we need to lose body fat. That's typically the first thing that kind of comes into mind of, you know, doing a tidy up phase. And it's more of like a digestive reset than anything. And like being able to give themselves room to do another all season phase, where the reason we're taking the step back is so that we have that vector of progression again for 18, 20, 24 weeks, because we're at this point now where like you said, the actual tissue gain per week spent and or fat accrual that's happening is just not worth that ratio. And we can actually be a bit more productive by pulling that athlete back and seeing these subjective metrics drastically improve, hunger signaling come back. A big one that I'll use is hunger upon wake. Like if they wake up hungry for that first meal, that's a good sign we're trending back in the right direction. And then you'll see that hunger trend across the day. Sometimes that just requires like within that tidy up, you also see someone does cardio again. If they weren't doing it in the peak off season, it just comes back so quick. Especially on that side of like someone taking a lot of food, that digestive reset may only need 7 weeks, 6 weeks. And it's not to lose body fat. It's just to give them a vector of progress again.
Yeah, I think just what you mentioned, they do cardio and things improve. So it's like keep doing the things that you need to in the off season to be productive. Yeah. So, you know, keep your cardio in, manage sleep, stress, have a diverse diet, staying on routine. It's the basics that are going to keep you in a productive off season, not all this nuanced items of should I take my growth hormone 30 minutes or 45 minutes before my meal or something, right? So you know, stick to your basics and continue those, as that's going to be the primary to keep a leaner and longer off season phase. Mm-hmm. And then I guess to a point of what I actually just mentioned was timing. Yeah. There's been questions around this was, for one, does eating carbohydrates blunt exogenous GH actions? And so this is kind of, I'll give you this, the quick answer is that, you know, growth hormone is secreted in a fasted state with low insulin, because insulin does blunt growth hormone release from the pituitary gland. So that's where this whole idea came from. However, That's blunting secretion of growth hormone. If we're exogenously injecting growth hormone, nothing's going to stop that from occurring. So carbohydrates don't really matter for growth hormone and IGF-1 conversion. What we're trying to get out of growth hormone, the only thing that I would say is that carbohydrates and insulin rise do facilitate that growth hormone to IGF-1 conversion, which IGF-1 is really the big money item that we want for muscle gain and muscle retention. But there is some role for taking growth hormone fasted for a fat loss perspective, as growth hormone does a great job of increasing free fatty acids into the bloodstream, lipolysis. So timing in a fasted state would have benefit when you are like in a calorie deficit. So that's the time when I would say, yeah, you would want to do it fasted and not have carbohydrates around that time, just so growth hormone can, you can really take the full advantage of liberalizing free fatty acids from fat stores. But as far as it, carbohydrates blunting the action of what you're trying to get out of growth hormone IGF-1, no, there's no issue around that. That's my only big timing aspect between fat breakdown and muscle gain around growth hormone. The other thing I would put in consideration, which it goes back to our thing about managing blood glucose and timing GH like around meals, is I use a phrase like, think of growth hormone like calories. The most important thing about your diet, right, is your total calorie intake. A little bit less importance would be when you're timing those calories throughout the day. It still matters, but not as important. Mm-hmm. Same with growth hormone. The most important thing is the total growth hormone you're taking for the day. Of lesser importance is how you're going to divide out that growth hormone throughout the day. There might be some aspects that you could max out GH to IGF-1 conversion around a certain amount of growth hormone. There's a certain amount of growth hormone that also might max out lipolysis and just mobilization of fatty acids. So it could be good rationale to divide out your growth hormone dosages. And when I see the greatest benefit in this, and I just saw it for one in prep, is managing, because growth hormone, we can look at these hormones, but also impacts some other hormones too, which one being aldosterone causes water retention. So if you have a large spike in growth hormone, you'll also have a large spike in aldosterone. And what I find is if you spread the dosages out, you have more stable aldosterone levels and less water retention swings that I found. You seem less responsive to sodium increase as well. And so of doing that on prep, I could tolerate much higher growth hormone than doing this large amounts in one strike. It also goes like, hey, if you're having that occur and you're getting water retention, hands are tight, you probably make sure you're watching blood pressure for one, but also it could be rationale to address that root issue with like an ARB to help with managing some of that water retention. Mm-hmm. So there's that aspect where when I think you get better blood pressure management, less stress on all the organs because of that too. Then also blood glucose is keeping more stable growth hormone levels or not as large as spikes. You might have a better area under the curve for insulin needs. And there was a study looking at this with, it was in children, but they gave growth hormone at night versus growth hormone in the morning. And doing growth hormone at night caused a total of a 24-hour period lower insulin needs than the group taking growth hormone in the morning. So there is rationale of like timing as far as like maybe that first dose should be at nighttime if you're in the off-season setting. Now, if you're in contest prep, it's a different scenario. We're not children, and we're also doing morning cardio and things and aspects that would cause benefit for growth hormone in the morning. But it just continues to further the rationale between trying to time growth hormone around times when it have high bioavailability and also times where you might be okay having a rise in blood glucose. Another time would be around training. And so timing a dose, like you could argue pre or post workout. I do pre, just because this stuff takes a long time to actually get into the serum. It's not like post-training, there's a release of growth hormone from your pituitary gland. It takes about 3 hours to reach a peak level once you inject some growth hormone sub-Q. So 3 hours post-training is way after the post-training window. So it might make more sense to do it pre-workout to where you're starting to hit that growth hormone rise in the post-workout period. And then elevations are up for like 10 hours after you inject growth hormone. So with that being said, like things that get into that long duration of active life, timing becomes far less important. When we get more into the 24-hour period for things, like say telmisartan has an active life of 24 hours, timing doesn't matter anymore. You just take one pill per day because it's going to be stable levels. But for growth hormone, like a 10-hour life, you could justify some timing, but it's of much less importance. But I would do it more so from the water retention stability and also the blood glucose stability over having like the muscle gain and fat loss aspects that it brings.
I think just kind of to piggy off back off the conversation of like application and on all seasons, I do think that this points to not needing to cycle off growth hormone either. As in there's utility within pretty much every phase of the season of influencing that growth hormone to IGF-1 pathway for better outcomes from a tissue perspective. So, you know, there certainly wouldn't be a need for growth hormone being cycled on and off. And then as we pointed out with the insulin is a needs basis based off managing response to a higher level of food intake and just covering that need for an individual where the cycle off of insulin is just when that need drops off in a deficit, that's where you're just cycling off. And so I think that kind of covers one of the questions on our list of there's application within all season and contest prep and how this is done from an administration standpoint that points to growth hormone not really needing to be cycled off and insulin's just done based off need.
Yeah, there's you're going to have a level required, right, for muscle retention mm-hmm. that you've built into. Some people might not be using it at all, or maybe, hey, when I go into a growth phase, I put some in, then for a cruise phase, I pull that out until you're then like a pro bodybuilder where, you know, maybe your baseline is 5 IUs of growth hormone, then you bring up to 10 IUs. So it's just a phase-dependent rise and drop-off, and some of that's going to be facilitated around what do you need for growth to occur, then also managing health markers to occur. So you see that kind of up and down. But you can think of it as like TRT. Like on a normal man, there's going to be growth hormone production that happens all the time, just like testosterone. So that might just be bringing it back down to a physiological norm, which we see sits within that like 2 to 3 IU mark. So that might be your baseline. And then you might be toggling up as needed based on the phase.
Agreed.
What other questions do we have
here? The gut one.
Okay. There is the gut one. Does insulin or GH cause large guts? And yes and no is the question. There's some indirect aspects that I would say would be around that. Again, we don't have like phenomenal look at these bodybuilders and what's occurring, but we do see that, you know, steroid users in general have a greater increase in visceral fat than their non-steroid using counterparts. So just in one, just using steroids could cause a greater partition to visceral fat gain, visceral fat gain, for one, it just makes the abdominal cavity expand, right? There's just more stuff in it. Now that also can make someone more insulin resistant too. Visceral fat produces a lot of inflammatory cytokines and kind of perturbates that issue. So there's that component. Also, what also goes along with trying to be a large bodybuilder, high amounts of food. So just large food volumes in the off season stretches out the gut and you lose waist control. And there you go. You start to have the increase of waist size and stretching of those tissues. So for one, make sure you're managing your food volumes the best that you can with good digestion, not getting excessively bloated all off season. Now, also, just being a larger human requires larger organs. And this has been looked at for those just in athletes, that organ size increases with muscle mass gain. And so you just need bigger body, bigger organs to fuel everything. Now, couple that with growth hormone, which can cause growth of all tissues, or even steroids for that matter, it could cause even larger increase of those organs. So you could have liver increasing, the GI tract increasing, the heart, you know, it makes everything grow. So we're seeing organ size increase in those individuals, larger food volumes, stretching out the waist, and then on top of it, potentially more visceral fat gain that does occur. So I think those are some of the areas that indirectly and directly growth hormone could be impacting to see larger waist occur. You know, with the management side, what I do see that guys that grow really fast usually have issues with this more so than guys that took their time. And so we think about it too. They're probably those guys that pushed the calorie surplus really hard, lots of food, stretching out the waist, faster growth rates also means faster growth rates of all the organs as well, which is also going to make from a training aspect harder to continue to train the waist to control it all off season. So I think you're just creating a situation where you could easily have your waistline fade out by growing too fast. So trying to space that out over time, not be overly aggressive would be the wise thing to do around it, but also do accept that your waist is going to increase to some degree if you're trying to get to be a large human. Even some of the best guys I see, it's still a degree of change.
Yep, you know? 100%. And I think it's something that can be managed well with just vacuum work and abdominal work to increase waist control and better food management in the off season. This could also lead to, like, you know, not going to stuff yourself at the Chinese buffet every time you go have an off meal. Like, that's just like classic step one. And I've never had Chinese, so I don't even know if that's good. But that would be like, John's like, no. But those kinds of things and managing like your meals off plan and still having like caloric goals within that can really help with you managing that waist control, you know, out for the variables that are a little bit more controllable outside of the PD and growth usage that's required to compete at the highest level.
And then another question here is, should I not eat fat with exogenous insulin? And it's goes back to like the insulin carbohydrate obesity theory that, you know, insulin is the root cause of diabetes. And that also, if you eat fat, insulin is a storage hormone that you're just going to make you store fat. We know this not to be true, though, that whether your surplus is from calories or fat and excess, it's going to cause fat gain. But now fat is a little bit more direct path to storing as fat, but all things the same, if you're in a deficit or you're in a surplus, too much of either macronutrient can cause fat gain. Too high in serum fatty acid levels can cause insulin resistance. Same with carbohydrate. More so along what we've talked about around inflammation. Mm-hmm. So both in excess can be problems. Now, from what we do in bodybuilding, typically we're already following very low-fat diets anyway. So I don't see a need to remove fats at times when you might be utilizing insulin. Even in the peri-workout window, some bits of fat could be present. Usually I kind of spread those evenly throughout the day. However, there might be a few shifts that do occur, but again, it's not so from the point of that if they have a large insulin rise and they have some fats present, that's going to go straight to fat gain, because it just evens out throughout the day anyway, as long as they're in an appropriate calorie surplus. And that's the real key here, is just manage your calorie surplus, and that should be enough on its own. But in a typical bodybuilding diet, we're also not using excessive fats either. And the fats that we even use aren't high, like saturated fats that might cause more insulin resistant issues than using like your unsaturated fatty acid choices. So again, I don't see any reason to have to completely remove your fats from times when you might be using insulin. My main programming around fats is to manage appetite and hunger, and I might taper those down carbohydrate wise towards the evening and raise fats up in turn, but it doesn't have to do anything with if we're using exogenous insulin around training or not.
Yep. Mine's the same exact logic, GI disturbance, everything.
And that might be one of our last questions. Do you need to take T4 with growth hormone?
Yeah. Do you need to take T4 with growth hormone? Typically, no. You're going to see like conversion from T4 into T3. But I'm not replacing that with most people within growth hormone usage. I would more so see the need arise. I see this in athletes that are just been competing for years and years, going through this diet and cycles and surplus cycles, more so than specifically with growth hormone needing replacement.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like in the growth hormone deficient population, if you look at those, that research, bringing it back in for those individuals might necessitate thyroid hormone. But again, these are individuals that might have an already skewed risk of being hypothyroid, and it just growth hormone now exposes that. So it's someone that was already going to go there anyway. Or if you had someone that was already borderline, it might expose that underlying condition, bringing in growth hormone. What you see in like normal healthy individuals that bring in growth hormone is that there's initial rise in TSH and decrease in T4 levels, but there's also an increase in peripheral conversion of free T3. So it's actually kind of a metabolic benefit. And because of that, that's why TSH is increasing, but it doesn't mean you need to take thyroid hormone yet. Now, what we do see is that over time, those levels actually normalize. And so thyroid TSH comes back down. But if you're going to a point where you're using a lot of growth hormone, it very well might mean that you might need T4 or to take like a combo therapy with T3. But again, it's individual based. So we just watch the labs, and like a thyroid HRT would go in place if we see the need. Now, if you're a long-term competitor going through the rigors of contest prep and off season, what I found is like putting in and pulling out thyroid hormone, a lot of times I end up just keeping it in year round. And keeping that stable hormone environment. Cause we do see like, even with long-term thyroid hormone usage, if you were to go that route, that thyroid hormone comes right back. And this is even studies here where they've used it for like 10 years straight and removing it, thyroid functions right back. So I rather have a more stable thyroid hormone environment and just run thyroid. If you're planning to be a competitive bodybuilder, just run it year round. That way, like even off the, it's just the logistics side of it too, right, Luke? Because we know like if someone goes in a calorie deficit, thyroid hormones goes down like within the first week. And so when are we going to pull labs? Well, not every week, not right off the beginning of a prep. Usually it's 10 weeks in when you probably want a thyroid hormone in way before that anyway. So it makes a good case for just starting off a prep with thyroid hormone in place. And for that matter, then you have post-show waiting for thyroid to come back up. Then off-season, you're using growth hormone, and that might, you know, cause some transition that you just run a baseline thyroid on your need for year-round as a competitor.
Yeah, I think that covers all of our questions. Yeah, looking over it, I think we hit everything.
Yeah, I think that does hit most of them. I'm sure there's some other ones out there. You're welcome to, if you're watching on YouTube, leave them down in the comment section, and maybe Luke and I can have some reels around that or do another one on growth hormone and insulin. We probably should re-hit these for actual maybe growth hormone usage for fat loss or for muscle gain. But this stuff, it's real straightforward. You know, it's not complicated about the drug usage. And I already mentioned, if you listen to this podcast, I already told you what matters for taking growth hormone. And how to make the most of it. It's very, very simple. Don't listen to these guys that try to overcomplicate
it. No, it's not needed
at all.
No.
So.
Well.
But anyway, everybody, thank you everyone for tuning in, and we will talk to you next time.